Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 28th. And we're very happy to be joined by America guest editor, Father Fran Heasel. Welcome, Father Fran.
Why, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Father Fran, maybe you can begin by just introducing yourself. You are a New York Province Jesuit, but you have been in the missions for most of your ministry.
That's right. I like to say that I came from a backwater, Buffalo, which was where I was raised until the age of 17, entering the seminary at St. Andrews. After the course of studies, I went out to Micronesia, and I've spent pretty much all my adult life there. Micronesia, for the uninformed, is the group of islands in the northern Pacific, just above the equator, stretching from the Marshalls to Palau. That is just a little bit off of the Philippine group. So that's where I've worked for all those years.
Now, how did the Jesuits get involved out there? How did the New York Jesuits get involved?
Well, the New York Jesuits got involved against their will, as it turns out. There was a provincial, this is right after the war, who swore that New York Province would not take on an additional mission. They already had the Philippines and Puerto Rico. So when he was asked to do this, he said, there is no way that we shall take on another mission. Within a year, we had the other mission. There are certain people who can't be denied. And one of them asked for New York support. You see, the Jesuits had been working in Micronesia since 1920. This was the Spanish Jesuits. They got it when the Pope reputedly asked three different religious orders if they would take the islands, and they all pleaded that they didn't have the manpower to do that. So he talked to the Jesuit superior and said, remember that fourth vow, the vow of obedience? You will take this, won't you? And so it was done.
Now, I understand my brother actually used to work for the New York Province and visited there once. And from what he told me, I mean, it sounds like it would be a real challenge because you've got these islands are pretty far apart.
That's right. It's they were served, when I first got there, they were served by a plane that that got around about once a week. So Friday for Chuuk was mail day. That was the day when that brought the issues of magazines and personal letters, and, you know, there really wasn't much communication other than that, except for ham radio. A lot of messages were dealt with through ham radio in those days. But other things? These were decidedly pre-computer times.
And what kind of work were the Jesuits involved in? Education, other kinds of ministry?
Well, the Jesuits did basically pastoral ministry. So at a time when there were no local priests, well, that's not true. There was one local priest from Panape who had been educated by the Spanish. But at a time like that, there was a need for priests all over. So we ended up with about 40 or 45 priests, mostly from New York, although not entirely, working in these different island groups around the area.
And what were the religious background of some of the, or is it mostly Christian, the people who live there, mostly Catholic?
It's almost entirely Christian now, but it's divided between Protestant and Catholic. About a little over 50% of the population in Panape and Chuuk, these are two major island groups, are Catholics. The rest would be Protestant, but it's very rare to find somebody who's not either a Catholic or a Protestant in any of these places.
And are the ways they perhaps incorporate some of the local cultural traditions into their faith practice?
Yes, like in the season of Lent, well, towards the end of Lent, as at the end of Advent, in Ponape they have a public penance service. Each parish has one. And they will perform a traditional rite, which involves pounding a root of the sakao or kava plant, and putting this into a cup and passing this to the celebrant who receives it on behalf of the community, receives it as an acknowledgement of their sorrow and their contrition, offers it up, then takes a sip and passes it to other people.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, you're now on sabbatical. Is there some chance you will return there at some point?
I hope so. I'm getting homesick for the islands, really. I'm hoping that I'll be back this summer.
Well, what's it been like? I mean, you've been there so much, you know, most of your life, you know, making the transition. Is it a real culture shock coming back to the United States?
It always is. I've been coming back every 2 years or so, but it's still an adjustment problem. For one thing, that you do miss the people that you've worked with. I mean, any missionary goes through that sort of a process. At some point or other, of course, it's necessary to give this up, you know, because of bad health or other things. Father Kovenbach, the former general of the Jesuits, used to say that the missionary has two gifts to give to his people. One is envoi, bringing himself there, and the other is renvoi, returning to his own place.
So it's difficult to find when that moment is, when
that's
the,
right.
the correct moment. Well, we're going to transition to talk about an article you have in the current issue where you kind of look at some of the lessons you've learned over your life and some things that you offer, kind of spiritual lessons you offer for younger folks. Not giving anything away here. You write, you're 72 years old, and you think that there's certain lessons you offer. But I want to begin with the first sentence of your piece, which is, life gets simpler as you get older. Maybe you can expand on that.
This is the truth. It's like picking up a subway map. It's looking at a subway map and trying to make sense of it, as I did recently when one one kind New Yorker came up and said, "You look confused, sir. Can I help you?" I was confused. You know, I'm not used to the subway system. But as you age, you get used to the subway system, more or less. You get used to the turns, which subway you take. You get used to how to deal with the common occurrences in life. You don't need that map anymore. Life gets simpler. You know, you fly on instinct.
Right. You mentioned this is the first of your lessons. You offer six. Relax and let instinct take over. Perhaps that might be easier said than done for a lot of people.
That's right. But it's difficult for all of us because we're always trying to figure things out. We're always trying to create plans for ourselves. You know, just as we prize our freedom, of course, but still we're interested in determining, making sure that we have the choice of marriage partner, job, you know, salary, and all the rest of it. Actually, I found that the best things that have happened to me have happened through what I would call non-plans, you know, things that have just happened, accidents, if you want, or impulsive decisions on my part, such as when I volunteered for the missions. I decided one day to simply write to the provincial and volunteer for the missions after I had been reading a book on them. I had never really seriously considered the idea before. He took me up. He said, "You're going. Get a physical exam first." And I've been happy there ever since.
Well, that leads into your second lesson, which is sometimes the big choices are simple. And for you, that was among the biggest choices in your life.
That's right. The choices are simple because, again, it's this instinct principle. It's the fact that somehow or other, your system, your heart, if you want, knows. It speaks a language that most of us, many of us, don't bother listening to. It speaks a very simple language. It speaks a language of sometimes what we call emotion, but that's to dismiss it too quickly, I think. I found it helpful in dealing with other people, even people who profess to be non-Christians or possibly even enemies of Christianity, theism, that if you're listening hard, you'll find a response in them that's very much like the response that you'd make yourself. So my years have taught me that Karl Rahner was onto something when he talked about anonymous Christians. I find them all the time.
Is this mostly in your work in the missions you discovered this?
Yes, but I think also being back here. You know, I come across many people who apologize at the beginning of the conversation when they find out I'm a priest. "Oh, I'm sorry, Father, but I don't practice," you know, or some such. And I say, "Don't worry, just give me half an hour's conversation and let me gauge for myself whether I call you an anonymous Christian or not."
Yeah. Well, you mentioned another of your lessons. You just kind of hinted at it before. You know, we see better with our hearts. On one hand, when you get older, your vision gets, it becomes more difficult to see, but physically see. But you say if you let kind of your emotions take over a bit, maybe it's easier to see people that way.
That's right. I find now instinctively when I meet a person, I don't look at, of course, I don't just look at the features. And I'm not, my first question is not, what college did you graduate from or what degree did you have? What I'm trying to do is take stock of the person in a different way. Sort of size a person up, if you want. Not to get leverage, but to understand how I should deal with them, him or her. But, I mean, it's a matter of figuring out how will I navigate this course of conversation? How will I be as kind and supportive and helpful as possible? Because that's really what I want to do. How can I do this without jumping in something that's perceived as attack mode by the other person? So you're taking stock of people and trying to figure out how to deal with them, all because you want them to feel supported and helped and encouraged, you know, rather than the opposite.
Yeah, you're right. Old age is wonderful as we become more forgiving, more understanding, more tolerant. Is this just the function of experience that, you know, you having had relationships with people and realizing that sometimes the things you think are the biggest deal in the world really aren't? Is that how you learn to forgive, for example?
I think so. But I think that I think also your fantasies, at least my fantasies, are more and more as I get older. People coming up the mountain together, that wonderful passage from Isaiah. People coming up the mountain together, some yellow, some brown, some black, some whites, you know, bringing their different gifts and reuniting, if you like, coming to a final communion. Those are the fantasies that I have.
So, yeah, we see ourselves as part of a common humanity kind of on the pilgrim path and kind of trying not to leave anybody behind.
That's right.
Okay, another area of lessons. As life lengthens, the ego shrinks. I mean, you talked about this before about... you're not talking about, you know, what your degrees, you're not kind of resume driven as you get older.
That's right. You forget about all that. You know, you shed that sort of a thing. You realize that that's not really important at all. But even your ego, even such things as what I want to do, you know, the great things that I want to do. Now, I mentioned that in another part of this, I suppose. But that becomes less important. What happens is, I think you get into the mode where you begin to understand that the purpose of life is to surrender to the Spirit, to surrender to the Lord. You become less ashamed about this. You know, you say, well, okay, I'll still have my agenda, but my agenda, I'm even willing to surrender my agenda if it comes to that. Because whether you like it or not, surrender is everything. Particularly as you get older, as you prepare for the final surrender, surrender of your own life.
Now, is there something particularly Ignatian or Jesuit kind of spirituality that has helped you to understand this? I'm just thinking of the famous Jesuit hymn where it says, Lord, you know, take and receive. Take and receive, yes.
That's right. Yes, that's very much a part of it. And, of course, the examples are part of it, too. The lived examples of... Well, the saints, but even contemporary saints, you know, people like Pedro Arrupe, who suffered a stroke and was incapacitated for 10 years, and who, when he was called into the aula at the congregation, had somebody read a statement that said, ever since my youth, you know, what I've subscribed to is, and then he went through the words of it, take and receive. And this, of course, has to be the life song of, or should be the life song of everyone. We should all learn to sing this.
Right, and it talks about taking mercy. My liberty is among the things that you have to surrender. Right.
That's right.
Right. Well, two more lessons. One is prayer is a warm-up for life. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, I dreaded prayer. You know, I dreaded prayer, truly, because when I was younger, this would have taken me through most of my career up to ordination, perhaps even a couple years afterwards. Prayer was a duty, a responsibility. Prayer was doing 45 minutes or doing an hour of spiritual exercise every day. And that was before I began to realize that the prayer really comes from within. It's not an imposition of ideas and pictures and so forth. That's just a startup. You know, the real prayer comes from inside us, and the real prayer isn't me declaiming, you know, for an hour or so. It comes from just a listening mode. That was the advantage of centering prayer, you know, the kind of exercise where you pay attention to your feelings, you try to follow your bodily sensation and so on. Once I began to realize that, prayer became much less a chore, and I began to understand it as a warm-up for a full day, I wouldn't want to call it exercise, but something that continued throughout the day. It was a warm-up, not the end in itself. And so sometimes the warmest feelings I got, or the most complete senses of times of self-surrender, were, as I mentioned in the article, when I was chasing a car in the city, or standing in the subway, or taking a shower, or something like that.
Kind of an unexpected moment sometimes.
That's right.
All right, well, let's go to your final lesson, which is our hearts expand as expectations contract.
Right. I wanted to do great deeds. I entered the Jesuits thinking, this is wonderful. I can influence people's lives by becoming a teacher, just like the scholastics that I saw at Canisius High School. I can do great things, I thought afterwards. I can go overseas and make a name, of course, all in the interest of the society and for Christ, but I can do this among the people there. You know, after a while, making a name isn't important. After a while, conquests aren't important. You know, the types of work that you've done aren't important. The goals that you've achieved, you know, aren't so important. What's important is simply hanging in. It's the Woody Allen thing. Huh? 95% of life, or 75% of life, however you want to say it, is just being there,
just showing up. Huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's true here, too. I think that showing up faithfully, doing what you can, living each moment, doing what you can to help people in their own struggles, seeing yourself as a fellow pilgrim, working with other people, encouraging others to climb a little faster or possibly even a little slower as they ascend that mountain together. These are the important things.
Well, finally, maybe in conclusion, we can discuss now these lessons. Do you think it helped that you live kind of a simpler life, and maybe that's just an assumption on my part, but that life in the missions was simpler than perhaps it would have been if you were living in the United States?
Well, it was certainly busier for me. I mean, I had no real think time in a way. It was when I came back here, and actually in the last couple months out there, that I began to put together these ideas. I began to think to myself, what have I learned after all? What can I share with other people? And that's when I started working on this piece. Yeah, I suppose that being in Micronesia, where people do live a simple life, helped. But I think I could have said the same thing even if I'd spent my life here in New York.
Of course, one of the callings of the Jesuits is to live a simple, that's one, you know, the vow of poverty. So presumably, even if you were here, it would have been still one of the callings
yes.
that you had. Right?
Yes. And our calling also is to reflect on what we're doing, that contemplation in action. Don't get so lost in work that you can't pull back, you know, from time to time to think a little bit, to reflect on its meaning. And maybe to sing a song of praise.
Well, we recommend, you know, if you want to read Father Hazel's song of praise, look at his piece in the current issue of America. And we want to thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tim.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. I encourage you to look online where we have a review of two documentaries on the infamous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. That's from Clayton Signe, who writes about labor issues for us. We also have an archive article from Father John Donahue on Teresa of Avila. A reminder, you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.